Chapter 20. Karaskand. The vulgar think the god by analogy to man, and so worship him in the form of the gods. The learned think the god by analogy to principles, and so worship him in the form of love or truth. But the wise think the god not at all. They know that thought, which is finite, can only do violence to the god, who is infinite. It is enough, they say, that the god thinks them. Memgawa, the Book of Divine Acts. For the sin of the idolater is not that he worships stone, but that he worships one stone over others. 8:9:4, The Witness of Fane. Early winter, 4111, year of the tusk, Karaskand. Immense timber and hide siege towers trundled toward Karaskand's western walls, driven by vast teams of mud-splattered oxen and exhausted men. Catapults hurled stone in flaming pitch, and wreathy archers raked the parapets. From flanking towers and the streets beyond the wall, heathens released soaring clouds of arrows. Throughout the packed ranks of Enrithi, men cried out, rolled in the muck, clutching wounded limbs. The towers groaned nearer, their sides sheeted in flaming tar. The men massed on their peaks, hunched behind their shields, peered through smoke, waiting for the signal. A horn blared through the din. The timber bridges slammed onto the battlements. Iron-armored knights surged across, crying, "Die or conquer!" Swinging great broadswords, they leapt into the spears and scimitars of the Kianine. On the ground below, thousands more rushed forward, raising great iron-hooked ladders. Stones and corpses crashed down upon them. Blistering oil sent men screaming from the rungs. But somehow they gained the summits, heaved themselves between the battlements, and fell upon the Fanum. Pitched battles were fought against woolen skies. Faithful and heathen alike toppled from the heights. The Nangaels, the Anpleans, and the dour Gesindelmen all managed to seize sections of the wall. More and more Enrithi spilled from the siege towers or clambered over the parapets, pausing only to glance in wonder at the great city exposed below. Some charged the nearest tower. Others were forced to crouch behind their teardrop shields as heathen bowmen began scouring the heights from nearby rooftops. Shafts flashed overhead, buzzing like dragonflies. Pots of burning pitch exploded among them. Men fell shrieking, trailing streamers of smoke. One of the siege towers erupted into an inferno. The other smoked so intensely that dozens of Nangaelish knights fell from the bridge, urged to rush blind by those choking behind. Then Imbeon and his grandees charged from the towers. Men grappled, hacked, and roared. Denied their siege towers and exposed to a whistling barrage of missiles from the city side of the wall, the Enrithi began falling more quickly than the ladders could replace them. Within moments, it seemed, every man boasted a dozen arrows jutting from his shield or armor. The knights striving against Imbeon found themselves pressed back through the screams and corpses of their kinsmen. At last Earl Iyengar, seeing the mortal desperation in the eyes of his knights, signaled the retreat. The survivors fell back to the ladders. Very few reached the ground alive. Twice more the Enrithi stormed the walls of Karaskand over the following weeks, and twice more the ferocity and craft of the Kianine drove them back with atrocious losses. The siege wore on through the rains and pestilence. Within days of identifying the sickness that caste menials called the Hollows and caste nobles, hemoplexy, the physician priests found themselves overwhelmed with hundreds complaining of headaches and chills. When Hepmascarala, the ranking high priest of Akiagni, disease, informed the great names that the rumors were true, that the dread god indeed groped among them with his hemoplectic hand, panic seized the holy war. Even after Gotian threatened deserters with trial censure, hundreds fled into the Anathpanean hills, such was the terror of hemoplexy. While the healthy warred and died beneath Karaskan's walls, thousands remained within their sodden makeshift tents, vomiting spittle, burning with fever, racked by convulsive chills. After a day or two, eyes would dull, and aside from bouts of delirious ranting, men would be robbed of all spirit. After 4 or 5 days, skin would discolor. Welts raised by the god's hand, the physician priests explained. The fevers would peak after the first week, then rage for another, robbing even iron-limbed men of all remaining strength. Either it broke, or the invalid fell into a death-like sleep from which very few ever awakened. Throughout the encampments, the physician priests organized lazarettes for those without retinues or comrades to care for them. The surviving priestesses of Yatwer, Anatke, Ancus, even Gira, as well as other cultic servants of the 100 gods, attended to pallet after pallet of prostrate sick. And no matter how much aromatic wood they burned, the stench of death and bowel gagged passers-by. Nowhere, it seemed, could a man walk without hearing delirious shrieks or smelling hemoplectic putrescence. The stench was such that many men of the Tusk took to walking through the encampment, holding urine-soaked rags to their faces, as was the Ainani custom during times of pestilence. The plague intensified, and disease's hand spared no one, not even members of the blessed castes. Kumor, Proyas, Keframuni, and Skeelt all succumbed within days of one another. At times it seemed the sick outnumbered the healthy. Shrial priests wandered through the wretched alleyways of the encampment, stumping through mud from tent to tent, searching for the dead. The funeral pyres burned continuously. In one grievous night, 300 Enrithi died, among them Imrothus, the Conryan Palatine of Adaroth. And the miserable rains waxed on and on, rotting canvas, hemp, and hope. Then the Earl of Gainry returned, bearing news of doom. Ever impatient, Athgieri had abandoned Carascand in the early days of the siege, charging through Anathpania with his Gainrish knights and some 1,000 more Curragalders and Agmundermen given to him by his uncle, Prince Sauban. He stormed the old Canaan fortress of Boke on the western frontier of Anathpania, taking it with few losses. Then he ranged southward, crushing those local grandees who dared take the field against him and raiding the northern frontiers of Umarna, where his knights were heartened to find good green land. For a time, he besieged the immense fortress of Mizarat, but withdrew once word came that King Ganjahoy himself had set out to relieve the fortress. Athgieri struck northeast. He evaded the tiger in the cedar-wooded ravines of the Betmula Mountains, then descended into Zarash, where he met and routed the small army of Utgarangi, the Sapata Shah of Zarash. The Sapata Shah proved a compliant captive, and in exchange for 500 horses and intelligence, Athgieri delivered him unharmed to his ancient capital, Garotha, the city reviled in the tractate as the harlot of Zarash. Then he rode hard for Carascand. What he found dismayed him. He recounted his journey for those great names fit to attend council, moving quickly to the intelligence offered by Utgarangi. According to the Sapata Shah, the Padiraja himself, the great Kaskamandri, marched from Nensafon with the survivors of Anwarat, the grandees of Kianadini, the homeland of the Kianin, and the warlike Gurgash, the Fainim of Nilnamesh. That night, Prince Skeelt died, and the Thunieri filled the showering sky with their uncanny dirges. The following day, word arrived that Kerjula, the Tidoni Earl of Warnoot, had also fallen, encamped about the walls of nearby Jaktha. Not long after, Sefrathindor, the Ainani Count Palatine of Hinant, stopped breathing. And according to the physician priests, Proyas and Kefaramuni would soon follow. A great fear seized the surviving leaders of the holy war. Carascand continued to rebuke them. Akiagni oppressed them with misery and death, and the Padiraja himself marched upon them with yet another heathen host. They were far from home, among hostile lands and wicked peoples, and the god had turned his face from them. They were desperate. And for such men, questions of why, sooner or later, always became questions of who. The rain drummed down across his pavilion, filling it with a humid, ambient roar. "So just what?" Ikuri Confis asked. "Do you want Knight Commander. He frowned. Sarcellus, is it? Though Sarcellus often accompanied Gotian at council, Confis had never been introduced to him, not formally. The man's dark hair matted his scalp, bled rainwater across what in childhood must have been a lovely and brattish face. The white surcoat over his hauberk was improbably clean, so much so that he looked an anachronism, a throwback to the days when the Holy War still camped beneath Momim. Everyone else, Confis included, had been reduced to rags or plundered Kianin attire. The Shrial Knight nodded without breaking eye contact. "Merely to speak about troubling things, Exalt General."
"I'm always keen for troubling news, Knight Commander, let me assure you."
Confis grinned, adding,
"I'm something of a masochist, or have you noticed?"
Sarcellus smiled winsomely. "The councils have made this fact exceedingly clear, Exalt General." Confis had never trusted Shrial Knights. Too much devotion, too much renunciation. Self-sacrifice, he'd always thought, was more madness than foolishness. He'd come to this conclusion in his adolescence, after perceiving just how often and how happily others injured or destroyed themselves in the name of faith or sentiment. It was as though, he realized, everyone took instructions from a voice he couldn't hear, a voice from nowhere. They committed suicide when dishonored, sold themselves into slavery to feed their children. They acted as though the world possessed fates worse than death or enslavement, as though they couldn't live with themselves if harm befell others. Rack his intellect as he might, Confis could neither fathom the sense nor imagine the sensation. Of course there was the God, the scriptures and all that rubbish. That voice he could understand. The threat of eternal damnation could wring reason out of the most ludicrous sacrifice. That voice came from somewhere, but this other voice? Hearing voices made one mad. One need only stroll through a local agora, listen to the hermits cry, "What? What?" to confirm that fact. And for Shrial Knights, hearing voices made one fanatic as well.
"So what's your trouble?" Confis asked.
"This man they call the Warrior Prophet."
"Prince Kellis,"
Confis said. He leaned forward in his camp chair, gestured for Sarcellus to take a seat. He could smell mustiness beneath the aromatic steam of his pavilion censers. The rain had trailed and now merely drummed fingers across the canvas slopes above.
"Yes, Prince Kellis," Sarcellus said, squeezing water from his hair.
"What about him?"
"We know that
we?"
The Shrial Knight blinked in irritation. Despite his pious appearance, there was, Confis thought, something about his bearing, some whiff of conceit, perhaps, that belied the gold-embroidered tusk across his breast. Perhaps he'd misjudged this Sarcellus.
Perhaps he's a man of reason.
"Yes,"
the man continued.
"Myself and a handful of my brothers."
"But not Gotian?" Sarcellus grimaced in a fashion that Confis found most agreeable.
"No, not Gotian. Not yet, anyway."
Confis nodded.
"By all means, continue."
"We know you've tried to assassinate Prince Kellis."
The Exalt General snorted, at once amused and offended. The man was either exceedingly bold or insufferably impertinent.
"You know, do you?"
"We think," Sarcellus amended.
"Whatever.
What's important is that you realize we share your sentiment, especially after the madness of the desert."
Confis frowned. He knew what the man meant. Prince Kellis had walked from the Carathay commanding the worship of thousands, and the wonder of everyone, it sometimes seemed, save himself. But Confis would have expected a Shrial Knight to argue signs and omens, not power. The desert had been madness. At first, Confis had shambled through the sands no different from the rest, cursing that damned fool Sasotian, whom he'd installed as general of the Imperial fleet, and pondering, endlessly pondering, mad scenarios that would see him saved. Then, after he burned through the hope that fueled these ruminations, he found himself harassed by a peculiar disbelief. For a while, the prospect of death seemed something he merely indulged for decorum's sake, like the fatuous assurances caste merchants heaped onto their wares.
"Yes, yes, you will die, I guarantee."
"Please," he thought, "who do you think I am?" Then, with a shadowy lassitude that characterized so much of that march, his doubt flipped into certainty, and he felt an almost intellectual wonder, the wonder of finding the conclusion to one's life. There was no final page, he realized, no last cubit to the scroll. The ink simply gave out, and all was blank and desert white. So here, he thought, looking across the wind-rippled dunes, lies my life's destination. This is the place that has waited for me, waited since before I was born. But then he'd found him, Prince Kellis, scooping up water in that sandy pit, waiting while he, Icuri Confis, died of thirst. Of all the deranged possibilities he'd considered, none seemed quite as mad as this, saved by the man he'd failed to kill. What could be more galling, more ludicrous? But at the time, his heart had caught, it still fluttered at the memory, and for an instant, Confis had wondered if Martimus had been right. Perhaps there was more to this man, this warrior prophet. Indeed, the desert had been madness. Confis fixed the Shrial Knight with an appraising stare. But he saved the Holy War, he said. Your life? My life? Sarcellus nodded. Indeed, and that, I would say, is the problem. How so? Confis snapped, even though he knew exactly what the man meant. The Knight Commander shrugged. Before the desert, Prince Kellis was simply another zealot with some claim to the site. But now, especially now, with a dread god walking among us, he sighed and leaned forward, his hands folded together, his forearms against his knees. I fear for the Holy War, Exalt General. We fear for the Holy War. Half of our brothers acclaim this fraud as another Inri Sejanus, as our salvation, while the other half decry him as an anathema, as the cause of our misery. Why are you telling me this? Confis asked mildly. Why are you here, Knight Commander? Sarcellus's grin was crooked. Because there'll be mass mutinies, riots, perhaps even open warfare. We need someone with the skill and power to minimize or forestall such eventualities. Someone who yet commands the loyalty of his men. We need someone who can preserve the Holy War. After you've killed Prince Kellis, Confis said derisively. He shook his head as though disappointed by his own lack of surprise. He camps with his followers now, and they guard him as though he were the Tusk. They say that in the desert, 100 of them surrendered their water, their lives, to him and his women. And now another 100 have stepped forward as his bodyguard, each of them sworn to die for the warrior prophet. Not even the Emperor could claim such protection. And still you think you can kill him. A drowsy blink, which made Confis certain, absurdly, that Sarcellus had beautiful sisters. Not think, Exalt General. No. Saraway's scream was like an animal thing, as much a grunt as a wail. Esmanet bent over her, combing her fingers through the girl's sweaty hair. Rain pulsed across the bellied ceiling of their makeshift pavilion, and here and there a trickle of water glittered in the gloom, slapping against plaited mats. For Esmanet, it seemed they crouched in the illuminated heart of a cave, littered by musty cloth and rotting reeds. The Kianine woman Kellis had summoned cooed to Serway in a tongue only Kellis seemed to understand. Esmanet found the throaty sound of the woman's voice soothing. They stood, she realized, in a place where differences of language and faith no longer mattered. Serway was about to give birth. The midwife sat cross-legged between Serway's opened knees, Esmanet knelt over her anguished face, and Kellis stood above them, his expression watchful, wise, and sad. Esmanet looked to him, worried. All will be as it should be, his eyes said, but his smile did not sweep her apprehension away. There's more, she reminded herself, more than me. How long had it been since Akamian had left her? Not that long, perhaps, but the desert lay between them. No walk, it seemed, could be longer. The Carathay had ravished her, fumbling with knot and clasp, thrusting leathery hands beneath her robe, running polished fingertips across her breasts and thighs. It had stripped her past her skin to the wood of her bones. It had spilled and raked her across the sand like seashells.
it had offered her up to Kellis. At first, she'd barely noticed the desert. She'd been too drunk, too juvenile with joy. When Kellis walked with her in Serway, she'd laughed and talked much as she always had, but it had seemed a pretense somehow, a way to disguise the wondrous intimacies they now shared. She'd forgotten what it had been like in her adolescence, before whoring had placed nakedness and coupling beyond the circle of private, secret things. Making love to Kellis and Serwe had taken what was once brazen and made it demure. She felt hidden and she felt whole. When Kellis walked with his Zaudunyani, she and Serwe marched hand in hand, discussing everything and anything so long as it returned to him. They giggled and blushed, used jokes to plot pleasures. They confessed resentments and fears, knowing the bed they shared brooked no deceit. They dreamed of palaces, of armies of slaves. Like little boys, they boasted of kings kissing the earth beneath their feet. But in all that time, she hadn't so much walked through as around the Carathay. Dunes like the tangle of tanned harem bodies, plains hissing with sunlight. The desert had seemed little more than a fitting ground for her love and the nearing ascendancy of the warrior prophet. Only when the water began to fail, when they massacred the slaves and the camp followers, only then did she truly cross the great thirst. The past crumbled and the future evaporated. Her every heartbeat belonged, it seemed, to a different heart. She could remember the accumulating signs of death, wasting as though her body were a candle notched with the watches, a light to read by. She could remember wondering at Serwe, who'd become a stranger in Kellis's arms. She could remember wondering at the stranger who walked with her own limbs. Nothing branched in the Carathay. Everything roamed without root or source. The death of trees, this she had thought was the secret of the desert. Then Kellis asked her to surrender her water. Serwe, she'll lose the baby. His clear eyes reminded her of who she was, Esmanette. She drew up her water skin and extended it with unwavering hands. She watched him pour her muddy life into a stranger's mouth. And when the last of it trailed like spittle, she understood. She apprehended, and with a brilliance no less ruthless than the sun. There's more than me. Kellis tossed her water skin into the dust. You are the first, his eyes said, and his look was like water, like life. Her feet scalded by gravel, her hair feathered by dust, her lips cracked by the sun, every breath like burning wool in her throat and chest. And then, impossibly, they came to good green earth, to Anath Pania. They stumbled into a rivered valley, into the shade of strange willows. While Serwe dozed, he undressed Esmanette, carried her into the transparent waters. He bathed her, washed the velvet dust from her skin. You are my wife, he said. You, Esme. She blinked, and the sun glittered through her water-beaded lashes. We crossed the desert, he said. And I, she thought, am your wife. He laughed, pawed at her face as though embarrassed, and she caught and kissed his sun-haloed palm. The waters that trailed from the flaxen ringlets of his hair and beard had been brown, the color of dried blood. Kellis built a shelter of stone and branches for Serwe. He snared rabbits, rooted for tubers, and made fire by spinning sticks into sticks. For a time, it seemed they alone survived, that all mankind, and not just the Holy War, had perished. They alone spoke. They alone gazed and understood that they gazed. They alone loved, across all lands and all waters, to the world's very pale. It seemed all passion, all knowing was here, ringing in one penultimate note. There was no way to explain or to fathom the sensation. It wasn't like a flower. It wasn't like a child's careless laugh. They had become the measure, absolute, unconditioned. When they made love in the river, it seemed they sanctified the sea. You, Esmanette, are my wife. Burning, submerged in clear waters, in each other, the anchoring ache. The desert had changed everything. Kellis! Serwe panted between contractions.
Kellos, I am afraid, she groaned and cried out. Something's wrong! Something's wrong!
Kellos exchanged several words with the Kianine matron, who rinsed Serway's inner thighs with steaming water, nodded and grinned. He glanced at Esmanette, then knelt beside the prostrate girl, cupped her shining cheek. She seized his hand and pressed her gasping mouth against it, her blonde brows knitted in panic, her look desperate, beseeching.
Kellos!
Everything, he said, his eyes bright with wonder, is as it should be, Serway.
You!
The girl exclaimed, gulping air.
You!
He nodded, as though hearing far more than one enigmatic word. Smiling, he wiped tears from her cheek with the flat of his thumb. Me, he whispered. For a heartbeat, Esmanette glimpsed herself as though from afar. How could she not catch her breath? She knelt with him, the warrior prophet, over the woman giving birth to his first child. The world had its habits. Sometimes events would pinch, tickle, or caress. Occasionally they would batter. But somehow they always funneled into the monotony of the half-expected. So many dim happenings, so many moments that shed no light, that marked no turn, that signaled nothing at all save elemental loss. For her entire life, Esmanette had felt like a child being led by the hand of a stranger, passing through this crowd and that, heading somewhere she knew she shouldn't go, but fearing too much to ask or to fight. Where are you taking me? She had never dared ask this, not because she feared the answer, but because she feared what the answer would make of her life. Nowhere. Nowhere good. But now, after the desert, after the waters of Anathpenea, she knew the answer. Every man she'd bedded, she had bedded for him. Every sin she'd committed, she had committed for him. Every bowl she'd chipped, every heart she'd bruised, even Maimara, even Akamian. Without knowing, Esmanette had lived her entire life for him, for Anasarimber Kellos. Grief for his compassion, delusion for his revelation, sin so he might forgive, degradation so he might raise her high. He was the origin. He was the destination. He was the from where and the to which. And he was here, here. It was mad, it was impossible, it was true. When she reflected on it, Esmanette could only laugh in joyous wonder. How distant the holy had always seemed, like the faces of kings and emperors on the coins she'd so coveted. Before Kellos, all she knew of the holy was that it somehow always found her at the pitch of her misery and humiliation. Like her father, it came in the small hours of the night, whispering threats, demanding submission, promising brevity, solace, and providing only interminable horror and shame. How could she not hate it? How could she not fear it? She'd been a whore in Sumna, and being a whore in a holy city was no mean thing. Some of the others jokingly referred to themselves as cut-purses at the gates to heaven. They traded endless, mocking stories about the pilgrims who so frequently wept in their arms. All that work to see the tusk, old Parasha had once quipped, and they end up showing it instead. And Esmanette had laughed with them, even though she knew those pilgrims wept because they'd failed, because they'd sacrificed crops, savings, and the company of loved ones to come to Sumna. No low-caste man was so foolish as to aspire to wealth or joy. The world was far too capricious. Only redemption, only holiness lay within their grasp. And there she was swinging her knees in her window like one of those mad lepers who, for no more reason than spite, threw themselves upon the unafflicted. How distant that woman now seemed, that whore. How near the holy. Serway wailed and shrieked, her body cramped about the agony of her womb. The Kianine woman cried out encouragement, grimaced, and smiled. Serway threw her head back into Esmanette's knees, puffing air, staring with crazed eyes, screaming. Esmanette watched, breathless, her limbs numbed by wonder, her thoughts troubled that something so miraculous could fit so seamlessly into the moment-to-moment banality of life.
Hebeserissa!
The Kianine woman cried.
Hebeserissa!
The babe sucked its first breath, gave voice to its first wailing prayer. Esmanette stared at the newborn, realizing it was the spoils of her surrendered water. She had suffered so that Serwe might drink, and now there was this squalling babe, this son of the warrior prophet. There had been branches after all. Crying, she looked down at Serwe.
A son, Sercha. You have a son, and he isn't blue.
Biting her lip, Serwe smiled, sobbed, and laughed. They shared a wise and joyous look no man save Kellis could understand. Laughing aloud, he lifted the screeching babe from the midwife's arms, peered at it searchingly. It quieted, and for a moment seemed to study Kellis in turn, dumbfounded as only an infant can be. He raised it beneath a glittering thread of water, rinsed the blood and mucus from its face. When it began squalling once again, he cried out in mock surprise, turned to Serwe with tender eyes. For an instant, just an instant, Esmanette thought she'd heard the voice of someone hated. He lowered the child and delivered it to Serwe, who cradled it and continued to cry. A sudden grief overcame Esmanette, the rebuke of another's joy. Keeping her face lowered, she stood, then wordlessly rushed out of the pavilion. Outside, the men of the Hundred Pillars, Kellis's sacred bodyguard, stared in iron-eyed alarm, but made no move to stop her. Even still, she wandered only a short distance among the ad hoc shelters, knowing that some fretting adherent would harass her otherwise. The Zaudunyani, the faithful, maintained an armed perimeter about the encampment at all times, as much to guard against their fellow men of the Tusk, Kellis had admitted, as against heathen sorties. Another thing, the desert had changed. The rain had stopped, and the air was cool and hard with dripping things. The clouds had parted, and she could see the nail of heaven, like a glittering navel revealed by raised woolen robes. If she lifted her face and stared only at the nail, she knew she could imagine herself any place, Sumna, Shygek, the desert, or even in one of Akamian's sorceress dreams. The nail of heaven was the one thing, she thought, that cared nothing for where or when. Two men, Galioth by the look of them, trudged toward her through darkness and muck.
Truth shines, one of them, his face still puckered from what had to be bad desert burns, muttered as they neared. Then they recognized her.
Truth shines, Esmanette replied, lowering her face.
She avoided their flustered looks as they passed.
Lady,
one of them whispered, as though choked by wonder.
More and more they acted shamefaced and servile in her presence, as though she herself were becoming more and more. Though it made her uncomfortable, their obeisance also thrilled her. And with the passing of the days, it seemed to embarrass her less and please her more. It was no dream. Notes rasped from the dark horizon. Somewhere, she knew, the shrial priests blew their prayer horns, and the Orthodox Enrithi knelt before their makeshift shrines. For a moment, the sound reminded her of Serwe's cries, heard from afar. Her grief tumbled into regret.
Why couldn't she give this moment of joy to Serwe, when in the desert she'd willingly given her her water, when she'd very nearly given her her life? Was it jealousy she felt?
No. Jealousy pursed one's lips into a bitter line. She hadn't felt bitter.
Had she? Kellis is right. We know not what moves us.
There was more. Always more. The mud felt cool beneath her toes, so different from furnace sands. Cries from a nearby tent startled her. It was someone suffering the hollows, she realized. Even as she backed away, she battled the urge to see who it might be, to offer comfort.
Please, a thin voice gasped. I need.
I cannot, she said,
staring in horror at the shadowy, leather and branch hut housing the voice. Kellis had cloistered the sick, allowing only the survivors of earlier outbreaks to attend those still ailing. The dread god, he said, communicated the disease through lice.
I roll about in my own excrement.
I can't.
How?
The wretched voice asked.
How?
Please, Esmanette softly cried. You must understand, it's forbidden.
He can't hear you.
Kellis. Hearing his voice seemed an inevitable thing. She felt his arms encompass her, his silky beard comb across her bare neck. These didn't seem inevitable. They almost surprised. "They hear only their own suffering," he explained.
"Like me,"
Esmonette replied, suddenly overcome with remorse. Why had she run?
"You must be strong, Esmonette."
"Sometimes I feel strong. Sometimes I feel new, but then..."
"You are new. My father has remade all of us. But your past remains your past, Esmonette. Who you once were remains who you once were. Forgiveness between strangers takes time." How could he do this? How could he so effortlessly speak her heart? But she knew the answer to that question, or so she thought.
Men, Kellis had once told her, were like coins. They had two sides. Where one side of them saw, the other side of them was seen. And though all men were both at once, men could only truly know the side of themselves that saw and the side of others that was seen. They could only truly know the inner half of themselves and the outer half of others. At first, Esmonette thought this foolish. Was not the inner half the whole? What was only imperfectly apprehended by others? But Kellis bid her to think of everything she'd witnessed in others. How many unwitting mistakes, how many flaws of character, conceits couched in passing remarks, fears posed as judgments. The shortcomings of men, their limits, were written in the eyes of those who watched them. And this was why everyone seemed so desperate to secure the good opinion of others, why everyone played the mummer. They knew without knowing that what they saw of themselves was only half of who they were, and they were desperate to be whole. The measure of wisdom, Kellis had said, was found in the distance between these two selves. Only afterward had she thought of Kellis in these terms. With a kind of surpriseless shock, she realized that not once, had she glimpsed shortcomings in his words or actions. And this, she understood, was why he seemed limitless, like the ground, which extended from the small circle about her feet to the great circle about the sky. He had become her horizon. For Kellis, there was no distance between seeing and being seen. He alone was whole, and what was more, he somehow stood from without and saw from within. He made whole. She bent her head back and gazed up into his eyes.
"You're here, aren't you? You're with me, inside."
"Yes," Kellis said, and it seemed a god looked upon her. She blinked two wondrous tears.
"I am your wife, your wife."
"And you must be strong," he said over the piteous voice of the invalid. "The god purges the holy war, purifies us for the march on Shima."
"But you said we needn't fear the disease."
"Not the disease, the great names. Many of them are beginning to fear me. Some think the god punishes the holy war because of me. Others fear for their power and privilege." "Did he fear an attack? A war within the holy war?"
"Then you must speak to them, Kellis. You must make them see."
He shook his head. "Men praise what flatters and mock what rebukes. You know that. Before, when it was just the slaves and the men-at-arms, they could afford to overlook me. But now that their most trusted advisors and clients take the whelming, they're beginning to understand the truth of their power, and with it, their vulnerability."
"He holds me. This man holds me."
"And what's that?"
"Belief."
Esmonette looked hard into his eyes. "You and Serwe," he continued, "aren't to travel unaccompanied under any circumstances. They would use you against me if they could."
"Have things become so desperate?"
"Not yet. But they could very soon. So long as Karaskand continues to resist us." Sudden, bottomless horror. In her soul's eye, she glimpsed assassins dispatched in the black of night, gold-adorned conspirators scowling by candlelight.
"They'll try to kill you?"
"Yes."
"Then you must kill them."
The thoughtless ferocity of these words shocked her, but she didn't repent them. Kellis laughed.
"To say such things on such a night," he chided.
Her earlier remorse came rushing back. Serwe had given birth tonight. Kellis had a son. And all she could do was wallow in her own lacks and losses. Why did you leave me, Akka? An aching sob welled through her. Kellis, she murmured. Kellis, I feel so ashamed. I envied her. I so envied her. He chuckled and nuzzled her scalp. You, Esmanette, are the lens through which I'll burn. You. You're the womb of tribes and nations, the begetting fire. You're immortality, hope, and history. You're more than myth, more than scripture. You are the mother of these things. You, Esmanette, are the mother of more. Breathing deep the dark, rainy world, she clutched his arms tight against her. She'd known this. Ever since the earliest days of the desert, she'd known this. It was why she'd cast her whore shell, the contraceptive charm the witches sell, across the sands. You are the begetting fire. No more would she turn aside seed from her womb. Early winter, 4111, year of the Tusk, the Menenor coast, near Iothea.
Tell me.
A towering whirlwind, joining armed earth to hoary heavens, belching dust and shrank into the skies.
What do you see?
Akamian awoke without crying out. He lay still, searching for his breath. He blinked tears, but he did not weep. Sunlight shone through his fretted window, illuminating the banded crimson carpet in the room's heart. He nestled deep into the warm sockets of his sheets, wondering at the peace of his mornings. The luxury alone seemed impossible. Somehow, after the destruction of the Scarlet Spire's compound in Iothea, he and Zynemus had found themselves honored guests of Baron Shenipal, the representative Proyas had left behind in Shygek. Apparently, one of the Baron's client knights had found them wandering naked through the city. Recognizing Zynemus, he delivered them to Shenipal, who'd brought them here, a luxurious Kianine villa on the Menenor coast, to convalesce. For weeks now, they'd enjoyed the Baron's protection and hospitality, long enough to forget their wonder at having escaped and to begin obsessing over their losses. Survival, Akamian was fast learning, was itself something to be survived. He coughed and kicked his feet free of his covers. His Shigeki attendant, one of two slaves Baron Shenipal had assigned him, appeared from behind a floral-brocaded partition. The Baron, who was one of those odd men whose graciousness or viciousness depended on how convincingly one catered to his eccentricities, had determined they must live like the dead grandees who once owned this villa. Apparently, the Kianines slept with slaves in their rooms, like the Norserai with their dogs. After bathing and dressing, Akamian prowled the halls of the villa, searching for Zynemus, who obviously hadn't returned to his room the previous night. The Kianine had left enough behind, mahogany-veneered furniture, soft brushed rugs, and cerulean wall hangings, that Akamian could almost believe he was the guest of a true Phanum grandee instead of an Enrithi baron who happened to dress and live like one. He found himself cursing the marshal as he searched the rooms. The healthy always begrudged the sick. Being shackled by another's incapacities was no easy thing. But the resentment Akamian suffered was curiously ingrown, almost labyrinthine in its complexity. With Zynemus, every day seemed more difficult than the last. In so many ways, the marshal was his oldest and truest friend. This alone made Akamian responsible. The fact the man had sacrificed what he'd sacrificed, suffered what he'd suffered, to save Akamian, simply compounded this responsibility. But Zynemus still suffered. Despite the sunlight, despite the silk and submissive slaves, he still screamed in those basements. He still betrayed secrets. He still cracked teeth in anguish. Every day, it seemed, he lost his eyes anew. And because of this, he didn't simply hold Akamian accountable. He accused.
Look at the wages of my devotion, he'd once shouted. Do the sockets weep? For my cheek feels dry. Do the lids wither, eh, Akka? Describe them to me, for I can no longer see. No one asked you to save me, Akamian had cried.
How long must he repay unwanted favors?
No one asked you for your folly! Esme, Zynemus had replied. Esme asked!
No matter how hard Akamian tried to forgive these tantrums, their poison struck deep. He often found himself mulling the limits of his responsibility, as though they were a matter for debate. What exactly did he owe? Sometimes he told himself that Zynemus, the true Zynemus, had died, and that this blind tyrant was no more than a stranger. Let him beg with the others in the gutter. Other times he convinced himself that Zynemus needed to be abandoned, if only to scrub him of his cursed caste noble pride.
You hold fast what you must relinquish, he once told the marshal, and you relinquish what you must hold fast. This cannot go on, Zin. You must remember who you are.
And yet Zynemus wasn't alone. Akamian had changed also, irrevocably. Not once had he wept for his friend, he, the weeper, nor had he cried out upon awakening from the dreams, not since escaping. For some reason, he just did not feel capable. He could remember the sensations, the roaring ears, the burning eyes and panged throat, but they seemed rootless, abstract, like something read rather than known. What was strange was that Zynemus seemed to need his tears, as though worse than the torments, worse than blindness even, was the fact that he, and not Akamian, had become the weak one. Stranger still, the more Zynemus seemed to need his tears, the farther they slipped from Akamian's grasp. Often it seemed they wrestled when they spoke, as though Zynemus were the failing father who continually shamed himself by trying to assert ascendancy over his son.
I'm the strong one,
he'd once bawled in a drunken stupor.
Me!
Watching, Akamian could muster no more than breathless pity. He could mourn, he could feel, but he couldn't weep for his friend. Did this mean he too had been gouged of something essential, or had he recovered something? He felt neither strong nor decisive, and yet he somehow knew he'd become these things. Torment teaches, the poet Protathus wrote, what love has forgotten. Had this been the gift of the Scarlet Spires? Had they burned some lesson into him? Or had they simply beaten him numb? Whatever the answer, he would see them burn, especially Iacchus. He would show them the wages of his new-found certainty. Perhaps that had been their gift, hatred. After querying several slaves, he found Zynemus drinking alone on one of the terraces overlooking the sea. The morning sun promised hot skin and cool air, a sensation Akamian had always found heartening. The crash of breakers and the smell of brine tickled him with memories of his youth. The Menenor swept out to the horizon, the turquoise of the shallows dropping into bottomless blue. Drawing a deep breath, he approached the marshal, who reclined with a bowl in his hands, his feet kicked upon the glazed brick railing. The previous night, Shanipal had offered to pay their way by ship to Jokthe, the port city of Karaskand. Akamian intended, no, needed, to leave as soon as possible, but he couldn't do so without Zynemus. For some reason, he knew Zynemus would die if he left him behind. Grief and bitterness had killed greater men. He paused, mustering his arguments, steeling his nerves. Without warning, Zynemus exclaimed,
All this dark!
He was drunk, Akamian realized, noticing the pale red stains across the breast of his white linen tunic. Dead drunk. Akamian opened his mouth, but no words came. What could he say? That Proyas needed him? Proyas had stripped him of his land and titles. That the Holy War needed him? He would only be a burden, he knew that. Shima. He came to see. Zynemus pulled his feet down, leaned forward in his chair.
Where do you lead, eh, Dark? What do you mean?
Akamian stared at his friend, studied the planes of sunlight across his bearded profile. As always, he caught his breath at the sight of his empty eye sockets. It was as though Zynemus would forever have knives jutting from his eyes. The marshal pressed a palm outward to the sun, as though reassuring himself of some fact of distance.
Hey, Doc?
Were you always like this? Were you always here?
Akamian looked down, stricken with remorse.
Say something.
But the words would not come. What was he to say? That he had no choice but to find Esmanet?
Then go. Go find your whore. Just leave me be.
Zynemus cackled, stumbling as drunks often do from one passion to another.
Do I sound bitter, Dark? Oh, I know you're not so bad. You spare me the indignity of Akkar's face. And when I piss, I need not convince myself my hands are big. To think.
At first, Akamian had been desperate for news regarding the Holy War, so much so he could scarcely grieve for Zynemus and his loss. For the entirety of his torment, Esmanet had seemed unthinkable, as though some part of him had understood the vulnerability she represented. But from the moment he recovered his senses, he could think of no one else, save perhaps Kellis. What he would give to hold her in his arms, to smother her with laughter, tears, and kisses. What joy he would find in her joy, in her weeping disbelief. He could see it all so clearly, how it would be.
I just want to know,
Zynemus cried in a drunk's cajoling manner,
who you fucking are.
Though at first he had only cause to fear the worst, Akamian knew she lived. According to the rumors, the Holy War had almost perished crossing Kamema, but according to Zynemus, she traveled with Kellis, and he could imagine no place safer. Kellis couldn't die, could he? He was the Harbinger, sent to save humanity from the second apocalypse. Yet another certainty born of his torment.
You feel like wind,
Zynemus cried, his voice growing more shrill.
You smell like sea.
Kellis would save the world, and he, Drusus Akamian, would be his counselor, his guide.
Open your eyes, Zin,
the marshal cried, his voice cracking. Akamian glimpsed spittle flash in the sunlight.
Open your fucking eyes!
A powerful breaker exploded across the black rocks below. Salty mist hazed the air. Zynemus dropped his wine bowl, slapped madly at the sky, crying,
Ha!
Akamian dashed forward two steps, paused.
Every sound,
the marshal gasped.
Every sound makes me cringe. Never have I suffered such fear. Never have I suffered such fear. Please, God, please.
Sin, Akamian whispered.
I've been good, so good.
Sin. The marshal fell absolutely still.
Akka.
His arms fell inward, and he clutched at himself, as though trying to squeeze into the darkness only he could see.
Akka. No. No!
Without thinking, Akamian hastened to him, embraced him.
You're the cause of this!
Zynemus screeched into his chest.
This is your doing!
Akamian held tight his sobbing friend. The broadness of Zynemus's shoulders surprised his outstretched arms.
We need to leave, he murmured. We must find the others.
I know,
the marshal of Atrempus gasped.
We must find Kellis.
Akamian lowered his jaw against his friend's scalp. He wondered that his cheeks were dry.
Yes, Kellis.
Early winter, 4111, Year of the Tusk, near Karaskand. The hub of the abandoned estate had been built by the ancient Canaans. On his first visit, Confis had amused himself by touring the structures according to their historical provenance, finishing with a small marble tabernacle some Kianine grandee had raised generations past. He despised not knowing the layout of the buildings that housed him. It was a general's habit, he supposed, to think of all places as battlefields. The Enrithi caste nobles began arriving in the afternoon, troops of mounted men cloaked against the interminable drizzle. Standing with Martimus in the gloom of a covered veranda, Confis watched them hasten across the courtyard. They changed so much, it seemed, since that afternoon in his uncle's privy garden. If he closed his eyes, he could still see them, scattered among the ornamental cypresses and tamarisks, their faces hopeful and unguarded, their manner arrogant and theatrical, their finery reflecting the peculiarities of their respective nations. Looking back, everything about them seemed so untested. And now, after months of war, desert, and disease, they looked grim and hard, like those infantrymen in the columns who continually renewed their terms, the flint-hearted veterans that recruits admired and young officers mortally feared. They seemed a separate people, a new race, as though the differences that distinguished Cunryans from Galioth, Ainani from Tidoni, had been hammered out of them, like impurities from steel. And, of course, they all rode Kianine horses, all wore Kianine clothes. One must not overlook the superficial. It ran too deep. Confis glanced at Martimus.
They look more heathen than the heathen. The desert made the Kianine, the general said, shrugging, and it has remade us.
Confis regarded the man thoughtfully, troubled for some reason.
No doubt you're right.
Martimus fixed him with a bland stare.
Will you tell me what this is about? Why summon the great and lesser name secretly?
The exalt general turned to the black, rain-curtained hills of Anathpania.
To save the Holy War, of course.
I thought we cared only for the Empire.
Once again, Confis scrutinized his subordinate, trying to decipher the man more than the remark. Since the debacle with Prince Kellis, he continually found himself wanting to suspect the general of treachery. He begrudged Martimus much for what had happened in Shygek, but not, strangely enough, his company.
The Empire and the Holy War traveled the same road, Martimus.
Though soon, he found himself thinking, they would part ways. It would be so very tragic. First Karaskand, then Prince Kellis. The Holy War must wait. Order must be observed in all things. Martimus had not so much as blinked.
And if...
Come, Confis interrupted.
Time to tease the lions.
The exalt general had instructed his attendants, after the desert he'd been forced to enlist soldiers to do the work of slaves, to take the Enrithi caste nobles to a large indoor riding room adjacent to the stables. Confis and Martimus found them spread in clots throughout the airy gloom, warming themselves over the orange glow of coal braziers, muttering in the low voices of sodden men, some 50 or 60 of them all told. For an instant, no one noticed their arrival, and Confis stood motionless beneath the arched entranceway, studying them, from their eyes, which seemed desert bright in the gray light, to the straw clinging to their wet boots. How much, he idly wondered, would the Padi Raja pay for this room? The voices trailed as more and more men noticed his presence.
Where's the Anasarimbar?
Palatine Gaedeki called out, his look as sharp and as cynical as always. Confis grinned.
Oh, he's here, Palatine. In theme, if not in body. More than Prince Kellis is missing,
Earl Guthyalk said.
So is Sorbon, Athgieri. Proyas is sick, of course, but I see none of Kellis's more ardent defenders here.
A felicitous coincidence, I am sure.
I thought this was about Karaskand,
Palatine Uranyanka said.
But of course, Karaskand resists us. We're here to ask why.
So why does she resist us?
Gotian asked, his tone contemptuous. Not for the first time, Confis realized that they despised him, almost to a man.
All men hate their betters.
He opened his arms and walked into their midst.
Why?
He called out, glaring at them, challenging them.
This is the question, isn't it? Why do the rains keep falling, rotting our feet, our tents, our hearts? Why does the hemoplexy strike us down indiscriminately? Why do so many of us die thrashing in our own bowel?
He laughed as though in astonishment.
And all this after the desert, as if the Karathay weren't woe enough. So why? Need we ask old Kumor to consult his omen texts?
No, Gotian said tightly. It is plain. The anger of the god burns against us.
Confis inwardly smiled. Sarcellus had insisted the so-called warrior prophet would be dead within days, but whether he succeeded or not, and Confis suspected not, They would need allies following the attempt. No one knew precisely how many Zaudunyani Prince Kellis commanded, but they numbered in the tens of thousands at least. The more the men of the Tusk suffered, it seemed, the more they turned to the fiend. But then, as the saying went, no dog so loved its master as when it was beaten. Confis glared at the assembled lords, pausing in the best oratorical fashion.
Who could disagree? The anger of the god does burn against us, and well it should.
He swept his gaze across them.
Given that we harbor in abet a false prophet.
Howls erupted from among them, more in protest than in assent. But Confis had expected as much. At this juncture, the important thing was to get these fools talking. Their bigotries would do the rest.